You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sorry to interrupt your conversations. We have today a session on the Middle East and North Africa, exiting the Great Recession, question mark. And we have a very strong panel to discuss that question from different angles. Masoud Ahmed, who is the director of the Middle East and Central Asia Department at the International Monetary Fund, so the International Monetary Fund's lead person on the region. Marina Ottaway, who is Carnegie's own director for the Middle East program, will look at the issues from the political and social angle. And Jean-Francois Seznec, immediately to my right, is a visiting professor at Georgetown University and an expert on the Gulf countries. This meeting is occurring against the background of the beginnings of a recovery in the world economy. That's why the title of the session is Exiting the Great Recession. And even though this recovery is actually more rapid and coming somewhat earlier than many forecast, nevertheless, there remain serious questions about the pace of the recovery going into 2010 and 2011 and its sustainability, especially as government support measures, massive government support measures, are withdrawn. Whatever happens, whatever kind of recovery we have, we are also aware of the fact that the post-crisis world will be quite a different world in the industrial countries for sure, with much higher debt levels and various changes in policies and regulations in the financial sector. But how is this all affecting this crucial region that is the source of a large part of our energy reserves and where political instability has traditionally played had very important impacts on the rest of the world? How will the Middle East, North Africa region cope with this period? And what will it look like after the crisis? Will it change? These are some of the questions which I hope Masoud, Martina, and Jean-Francois will address over the next 40, 50 minutes or so, if we give them 15 minutes or so each. And then hopefully that'll give us plenty of time for questions and answers. So, Masoud.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Uri, for organizing this session and for inviting me. And I'd like to thank also many of the familiar faces that were here 6 months ago when we actually had a similar conversation as well. And I want to use the time I have to focus a little bit on the economic aspects. I think the light is on, but I want to focus a little bit on the economic situation and the outlook, and also perhaps a little bit pick up on the point that Uri was raising about the what comes after the crisis for the countries in this region. And then I look forward to the comments and the contributions also of the fellow panelists and from you. Let me also say that outside you do have a copy of the regional economic outlook, which we have just released and which is the basis for what I'm going to say to you. And if you haven't picked up a copy, please do feel free to pick one up on the way out. And the presentation I'm using, I'm going to skip through some of the slides because I want to make it condensed, but the whole presentation will also be available on our website in the IMF, and I believe you're also going to put it up on the website here, so if anybody wants to access it, they can. So let me go straight in and talk first about the oil exporters in the region, and then I'll talk about the emerging markets and developing countries because they obviously have different factors affecting their outlook. When we look at the exporters, the basic messages that I'd like to put on the table for you are that the most obvious and immediate impact on them was through the fall in the price of oil, which did result in a dramatic impact in terms of their incomes for most of them. But they responded to this fall in the price of oil in two ways, which were very important. One was that they continued to spend, and consequently, they, if you like, introduced a bit of a short circuit in terms of the effect of the lower oil price on the rest of the economy, because as the governments continued to spend, they did counter-cyclical spending, and they did this quickly, and they did it decisively. And that has mitigated the effect of the lower oil prices on the economies as a whole. They also provided a lot of support to the banking sector in these countries, provided liquidity, provided capital, and I can go into more details, but that also helped to ensure that the banks were not directly affected as a result of the oil price fall. You're now beginning to see some signs of recovery as oil prices begin to pick up, and I'll show you a few slides on that. But the one issue which is not so straightforward is that alongside the fall in oil prices, which these countries were affected by, there was another phenomenon which also affected them, which is that in the run-up, in the 4 or 5 years prior to the crisis, they had all experienced very rapid growth of credit in their economies, to some extent financed by the inflows that were coming in from oil, but also from capital inflows that were coming in from abroad. And as a result of this, there was an increase in the price of assets, particularly real estate. And when there was a withdrawal of this capital, and when there was a change in the sentiment of investors within the economy, because the bubble had been growing, there was, as a result of that, a collapse in asset prices. And in some countries, this has hit the real estate market quite hard, and you've seen a 50% or so drop in real estate prices. That has then had a comeback effect on the banks, on corporations, on households, and that process is still working its way through the system. So what this has also shown, this crisis, is that there was a little bit of vulnerabilities that have been exposed in some of the financial sectors. Given the size of these economies and the resources that they have, these problems are all manageable. They're not systemic problems, they're manageable problems at the macro level, but they do cause dislocations and problems, including some social problems that are going to emerge because of that. And that's something that is worth thinking through. So that's, if you like, our basic story on the oil exporters. And I'm just going to show you a few slides, and forgive me, I'm going to walk through some of them faster than others. The first one, really, just to give you a magnitude of the drop in GDP in these countries that came from the drop in oil prices. And if you look at it, for the oil exporters, which are in green, they had a very sharp drop, almost as sharp as the advanced economies. And, of course, the reason for this was that oil is such a big part of their economies, and this, the production of oil went down. And so it was down to close to less than minus 4%. And then you see in 2010, oil production beginning to pick up. So quite a sharp recovery as well coming about. But now, as I said earlier, what they did when oil prices went down is that if you look at the left-hand panel, what you see in the yellow chart there, just looking at a couple of countries, they basically continue to spend more. They had the reserves, they built them up over many good years, which was actually very prudent and sensible policy, and now you come on to a lean period, and they continue to spend it for that year. Of course, you can't continue this for a very long period, but for many of these countries, it makes a lot of sense to do that during the period that they have. And then if you look at the right-hand panel, which has these three lines, the green line in this case is what happened to their economies outside of the oil sector, which in many ways is what really measures living standards for people in the economy. And if you look at that line, what you see is that, in fact, it did not go down quite as much because it was moderated as a result of the spending that the governments were doing. So the orange line, which is the oil GDP, fell a lot, but they, by continuing to spend, they basically prevented that from having a big impact on the rest of the economy. Now, one obvious consequence of this is that the large current account surpluses that they had built up over the previous years, this year, 2009, has gone down quite dramatically. If you look at the dark, I'm not sure what the color is, dark brown color here, you basically have the GCC countries, which are in many ways the core group of exporters here. And for them, the surplus went down, as you can see last year, from over 250 billion to now about 50. For all of the countries together, it went down from about 380 billion to about 50. So big drop in the surplus. And that makes, as we think, good sensible strategy to be able to use this reserve during this period. Now, let me just use a couple of slides to show the other point, which is what they was happening in the banking sector. This slide shows what was happening in the dark bars show in different countries what was happening to credit growth every year in the four-year period preceding the crisis. And what you can see is that in a number of countries, credit growth was running at quite high numbers. And one country which is not here, I think it's a I'm sorry, it sort of dropped off our chart, is the UAE. But in the UAE also, in some ways, credit growth was running quite high, close to 40 or 50% in some years, and in the last couple of years, even higher before the crisis. And of course, after June 2008, when the capital that had come in from outside was began to be withdrawn, when the banks themselves felt under pressure as a result of that and started to cut back on lending, when they raised their lending credit standards as a result of the sort of worldwide cautionary approach adopted by banks after Lehman, you see a sharp drop in new credit being extended to the economy. And that has meant that it's exacerbated the problem in terms of the asset markets, and particularly in real estate. Now, the countries did provide a lot of support to stabilize the banking sector, but it's still not lending and functioning in terms of providing credit to the economy. The other dimension of assets, of course, is not just real estate, but is stock markets, equity markets. And left-hand side shows you the big drop in equity markets that was taking place in these economies between the beginning of last year and through to about March of this year. As you can see, varying degrees, some of them, which had gone up a lot, came down the furthest. Since March, there's been a turnaround, as there has been in equity markets, in emerging markets more generally. But in no case is the equity market back at the level it was at before, from its peak. So in no case has it gone back up to its peak. I'm going to skip the bit about these two points here. The general point that we're trying to make is that so far, despite all this boom, one good thing is that these countries, which really were beginning to struggle with inflation at a time when this was beginning to pose a problem for them domestically, and also given the exchange rate regimes that they operate, it was a bit harder for them to keep up this high level of inflation. Well, you have seen that come down, and there's really no scope for at the moment, there are no signs on the inflationary front that we should be particularly worried about. Final slide on the oil exporters, just to give you a sense looking forward. And what this does is show you how the change in oil prices looking to next year is beginning already to reverse the big decline we saw this year. So if you look at what's happening on the left-hand panel, this is for the GCC countries, you see that this year, both the current account, as I said earlier, dropped dramatically, and the same thing applies to government finances. The fiscal balance also shrank. But next year, with oil price assumptions that we're using, and in the IMF, we basically don't make oil price projections. We just rely on the futures markets to give us a set of assumptions for the oil price, because we've discovered that we are no better at making any projections about the oil price. But at least we've drawn the consequence of that and not invest resources in trying to. So we do use the futures market for it. And I think just using those assumptions of about $77 oil price for next year, the surplus in these countries in the current account begins to get to about 150 billion again. And if you project this out, then over the next 5 years, you see somewhere between 600 billion and $1 trillion of current account surplus again building up in these economies. And of course, similarly, the fiscal balance also begins to improve. So our core message to countries, the oil exporters, is many of them have the fiscal space and the reserves to continue with public spending through next year. And we see public spending as being a part of the of the development of these economies. We do think that there is a job still to be done to ensure the orderly workout of financial and corporate balance sheet effects of these asset price falls. And I'll just leave a marker for, I'm sure, something that Marina is going to pick up, which is that in a way, what has been happening in these asset markets has affected many households in these economies, and that is raising, for them, the crisis feels far from over, although they haven't had the same kind of crisis that, of course, many other parts of the world have had. And finally, that for this group of countries, looking forward, the vulnerabilities that have emerged in the financial sector were partly due to the fact that the banks took on a sort of certain amount of leveraged risk, but also that it is still a very bank-based system, and the need to diversify and develop capital markets and to help intermediate some of the flows in the region is something that we still think is a priority going forward. Let me now turn quickly to the oil importers. And the oil importers are a more diverse group. Obviously, they include countries that are relatively well off, high income, and countries like Lebanon. And then they also include in this region countries that are low income countries, heavily dependent on donor assistance. So it's hard to generalize, but the basic points that I want to leave with you on the oil importers is that, first of all, the effect of the crisis on them has been relatively limited compared to other countries, similar countries in other parts of the world. And the reasons for that are that they are relatively limited in terms of their integration with the financial markets. They have gained from the spillover effect, the positive spillover effect of continued spending in the oil exporters, because they have trade links with the oil exporters in the region. They have workers who are working in these countries and sending remittances back. And they also have increasing links of investment and tourism across. So the fact that the oil exporters have continued to spend has helped not just their own economies, but their neighbors as well. And also, where they could, the policymakers in these countries have generally reacted sensibly and quickly to the crisis, trying to take the measures they could to contain it. So on balance, all of these things have helped to reduce the impact of the crisis on them. And as you can see, growth has slowed for them, but it slowed to 3.5% in this year, which this year is not a bad growth rate for many parts of the world. As I said, there are a lot of differences across countries, but this is the overall picture. Now, I do want to say one thing about them looking forward. For the same reasons that these countries have not been hit so hard in the downturn, they are not going to see a very quick rebound on the uptake. Because they're not so connected to global markets, they weren't hurt when the credit was being withdrawn, but they're not going to be as positively affected on the way up. And many of their trading partners, particularly in Europe, are going to see much slower rates of growth for the next 3 or 4 years than the last 3 or 4 years. So they'll be exporting into a more constrained market. And because unemployment is likely to rise throughout 2010 in the advanced economies and in Europe in particular, where many of them have tourism and they have also workers there, this will make it harder for them to see a quick turnaround on tourism spending or on an increase in workers' remittances. So not being hurt so much on the way down, but looking ahead, it doesn't look like 2010 is going to be a very, very much better year. It's going to be a little bit better than it is this year. We think a little over 4% growth. Again, a lot of variation across countries, but not a V-shaped recovery in terms of saying, okay, 2010 is going to be hugely better. Again, I have a few slides. I'm going to go through them even faster. The basic point I want to make on this slide is that the thing that has held up remarkably well, the left-hand side looks at what's happened to exports, tourism, remittances, and foreign direct investment. And the interesting thing about this slide for me is that tourism, remittances have held up remarkably well into the middle of this year. In some countries, actually, like Tunisia, tourism numbers are increasing and remittances are also pretty much unchanged. Still hard to say why that is happening, whether it's a price shifting effect where people are shifting their tourism, their holidays to less expensive destinations. You know, that might be part of the explanation. But that has helped them a lot. And in other countries, what's been really helpful is a good agricultural harvest. Morocco's had the best agricultural harvest in 25 years. Makes up for a certain amount of fall in exports. You do see some pickup. And just if you look at the left-hand panel here, the most recent data for the countries where we have it, and this is a region where data is not as recent and timely as it might be in some countries, but the most recent data that we have shows some pickup in the economic indicators in these countries. But as I said, our basic message is that if you look at growth next year. And the orange line on this is the oil importers in the region. Compare them to the green, which is emerging markets as a whole, and the dark brown, which is the world. So on the way down, Orange Line does reasonably well. But as you can see, for 2010, it starts falling below the average. So the important message to take away from this experience is not that being less integrated with the markets and with the world economy is helpful all the time, because if you look at it, you actually see that while it's helpful on the downturn, it is not helpful when things are going well. And that's, if you like, the question is, how do you prepare these economies for the future? And I want to show you just one more slide here, which is this one. And this slide is a little bit the challenge that I think these countries will face going forward. Inflation has actually come down a certain amount in these economies. Food prices have come down, commodity prices have come down, and so inflation has been doing better last year. But if you look at the right-hand panel, it's looking at what's been happening to their real effective exchange rates. And in virtually every case, the real effective exchange rate has been appreciating for these economies. And as the world gets a little more competitive going forward, as growth is slower in the markets to which they're exporting, as their competitors begin to have exchange rate depreciation, it does raise a question of makes it a little bit harder for these economies to take advantage of those more constrained opportunities if your prices are going to be higher in relative terms than your competitors. So I think competitiveness is going to be the big issue which many countries will be facing going forward. So what do we see as the priorities for these countries? As I said, the big priority that I would that we have been stressing is that think of preparing these economies now to be competitive and to be able to grow fast in a world environment which is going to be less benign than it was over the five-year period leading up to this crisis. And that means that the agenda of reforms on the supply side, which is to make these economies more competitive through structural reforms, the way in which business is done, all become, just that agenda becomes even more important looking forward. And it's essential because the key issue facing many of these countries is, of course, providing jobs for a growing and young population. And in a period where, in many cases, high unemployment and underemployment amongst the youth is not just an economic issue, but also a social concern. So that's, if you like, the key challenge that I see for these countries going forward. I hope you have a chance to comment today, of course, but I would also encourage you to come and comment on a blog that we are running at the moment in the IMF on the regional economic outlook for the Middle East, on which if you do have any thoughts or ideas that you want to post, please feel free to use that as well. So let me end with that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Masood. It is striking how the countries of the Middle East, North Africa, like many other developing countries, have been able to weather the crisis so far relatively well, although, of course, the impacts vary greatly across the regions and in different sectors. So let me then hand it over to Marina for taking on the dialogue on the political and social side.
Thank you very much, Uri. I think in discussing the sort of social and political consequences of the crisis, I'm going to follow in the same pattern that that was followed before, talking about first the oil-producing countries and then the non-oil-producing countries. They are two very different pictures. By and large, what we are not seeing now any very pronounced social consequences of the crisis, because although employment has dropped considerably in some countries, particularly in the construction sector, I would say that there are more unemployed crane in the Gulf area than anywhere else in the world at this point. It's very striking when you travel to that area now, the number of building sites when there is no activity going on. The rise in unemployment that comes from that dramatic slowdown in construction activity has been exported to other countries. In other words, the people who lost their jobs in this crisis are migrant workers rather than the citizens of the country of the countries themselves. The data is not very good because there is no clear, it's not so easy to keep track. But essentially what has been happening is that as jobs are lost, then people leave the country. So that in a sense, the increase in unemployment that comes, let's say, from the crash in the or the end of the building boom in Dubai is probably being felt somewhere in Bangladesh and Pakistan, and it's not felt in Dubai itself. And out there, essentially, it's too diluted in what is the general picture of the economies of these countries to really be a factor that you can easily see and easily measure. So that similarly, I think it's important to keep in mind that in most of the GCC countries, in most of the oil-producing countries, there is, particularly the GCC countries, Algeria is a bit different, there is very... the overwhelming majority of citizens is employed by the government. It's not employed in the private sector. Essentially, they are employed in a sector which is pretty much a recession-proof, particularly given what we just heard, that the fact that these governments have kept a high level of expenditure, essentially, for making up for the problems caused by the economy. So that there is really very little evidence that there has been an increase in unemployment among citizens, among the national population. So we have this exporting of the social consequences. Now, one question which is very interesting that needs to be raised, although this is more of a question for the future than a question for the present, is what are the political consequences of this situation? Because there is a crisis that has created a hardship on non-citizens. Many have left the country, some are still around. And this is, for many of the GCC countries, this is the majority of the population. Keep in mind that in the United Arab Emirates, it's about 85% of the population that's non-citizens. So that one question is, as the situation becomes more difficult, as many people are forced to leave the country without wanting to leave the country, not because they are ready, but because the jobs dry up, and with the jobs go their resident permits, essentially. Are we likely to see a political reaction at some point? There have been rumblings, but kind of distant rumbling of dissatisfaction. There have been some pressures on the part of immigrants groups to get the government to change the regimes that regulates migrant labor. But so far, really, there have been no serious changes. I think it in terms of distant rumblings rather than something which is happening right now. So that both from the political and the political point of view, the GCC countries have come through fairly unscathed from the crisis. I think when the citizens have been affected Then you see governments are trying to intervene, in some cases to the price of absurdity. In Kuwait, where in the boom period, a lot of citizens were taking out large loans, personal loans, credit card debts, and so on and so forth. There is a move underway in the parliament, which is not new, but it was something that was tried a few years ago, went nowhere, and now picking up again, to have the government simply writing off the personal debt of all citizens. In other words, the government paying the credit card debt of every Kuwaiti citizens. It may or may not happen. It's a populist enough parliament. If the parliament stays there long, if they don't have another crisis that leads to the parliament being dissolved again, they might do it at this time. But these are not things that are really, you know, in the greater scheme of things, are all that important. Now, when we move to the non-oil producing countries, I think we have a somewhat different picture. Although even there, and I think having those, the fact that we saw those figures earlier about the fact that the decline in production and in GDP was much lower, but also that the uptake is much slower than in other countries. Those figures are really helpful because there too, I think we are more likely to see a delayed effect of the financial crisis than an immediate effect of the financial crisis. What do I mean by that? So far, in our work in this area on the let me preface this by saying we are starting a project and looking at the sort of growing social unrest in the non-oil producing countries of the Middle East, because that's where it's being manifested. And it's while certainly social unrest, symptoms of social discontent are clearly becoming more pronounced, we have certainly not able at this point to say how much it's due to the general economic situation, which has been bad, which is chronically bad in a lot of countries, and how much it's due to the consequences of the recent fiscal crisis. There is no doubt that there is more social unrest, particularly in those countries with a large population, Egypt being one of the most prominent examples. Egypt has had more than 800 wildcat strikes last year. It had more in the vicinity of 600 the year before. They have been going up year by year. Again, we cannot see anything that suggests that this is directly a consequence of the financial crisis, but there is a chronically difficult situation in most of these countries, and certainly the financial crisis is not helping. Now, the question is, in order to understand that the possibility of a reaction, in other words, not just, you know, households suffering because they have lower remittances, but this difficult situation translating into political consequences, I think it's important to take a quick look at what is the overall situation in many of these countries. And I would argue that in most non-oil producing countries now, there is a shortage of safety valves. That is, and the main safety valve that we have seen recently have been fairly good growth rates, rates of GDP growth. There is no dramatic change in the sort of in economic policies leading to the increase in job creation and so on that you were talking about. We really have not seen much in terms of this kind of really strong program of economic reform. There is no political safety valve at all in these countries at this point. There has been whatever drive towards political reform existed in the early part of this decade has pretty much ground to a halt. There is really almost nothing going on the political front in terms of reforms that give people a hope that things are going to get better. The channels that would allow people to express their dissatisfaction in through political channels and have some hope for redress and so on. What there has been before the crisis started was a level of economic growth that we had not seen for many years. A level of economic growth that related to the general economic, what was the general economic situation in the world, which is also related to the fact that oil-producing countries have invested heavily, at least in some of the non-oil-producing countries. So that essentially for most of the non-oil-producing countries, the only safety valve that we saw in recent years has really been this fairly good rate of economic growth. Not a dramatic rate of economic growth. We are not talking about China, not a rate of economic growth that is going to change the equation immediately. But certainly that does make it possible for things to get somewhat better over a period of time. The 6%, 7% rates of economic growth that we have seen in a lot of countries. Now, what is likely to happen now is that the rate of economic growth is going to slow down. In other words, whatever safety valve existed or whatever in these countries is going to become weaker, or it's not going to provide the same relief that it did before. What does this mean? I think it's very difficult to really make any firm predictions. I'm not predicting that there is going to be, there are going to be huge social upheaval in any of these countries. But I think we are seeing a slow deterioration and increasing pressures that may very well have political consequences, particularly in those countries that are going to go through difficult periods of transition in any case. Egypt is going to go, just because of the President Mubarak's age, is going to go through a political transition soon, and it's very uncertain how that political transition is going to unfold. It would be much better for the country to have that difficult political transition in a period of high economic growth. This is unlikely to be the case at this point, unless President Mubarak beats all odds and stays around for a considerable longer period of time. So essentially, it's a slow mounting on pressures on countries that already have a lot of pressure on them, rather than an immediate and drastic new element that has been thrown into the situation in this country. So let me leave it at this and perhaps continue in the Q&A period. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So the picture that emerges is one of continuity rather than major change caused by, or disruption caused by the crisis. Good news in one sense, bad news in another sense. Perhaps Jean-Francois could take it from here.
A lot of the things I will say are very close to what was said before. Maybe I can just give a few of the main points that I will cover. Is I will focus mostly on the Arab Persian Gulf because that's really what I know more than many other things. And then I will make a couple comments at the end on two countries we haven't touched yet, which are of some importance in the region, Iran and Iraq. And a few of the points on the modern economy or what's going to happen, which actually I don't have a slide on, but I will discuss just in conclusion at the end. But this will be fairly rapid because a lot of the points were covered really well by Masoud's paper. So one thing is we have been told there are a number of people in this town who claims that the Saudis require $50 a barrel to break even. I think that's a probably a fair statement. By breaking even, we mean not just the cost of production, which is only $1.50 to $6, maybe say $4 average a barrel, but it needs to provide a lot of subsidies to the people and so on. But anything, when the prices are above 50, anything goes into the reserves. And here I've given you two figures. I realize that's a mistake. It probably should be closer to 40 billion in net increase in reserves per year, really, not 50, as I said, on the first line here. Altogether, that allowed the Saudis in particular to spend a lot of money, as you pointed out, in supporting the system. There's been over $100 billion drawn from the reserves of SAMA and put into various projects and subsidies. It did not really stop the economy from, or the banks from, freezing lending until now. It's taken this long, 8 months, for the banks to really start getting off their fear of the system, of the problems, and go back into lending, and they are doing so now because it took the state that long to get the projects which they're pouring money into started and going. I mean, the state-sponsored projects are absolutely humongous, and they're going along. They're just being developed. The King Abdullah City, they broke ground on it. You've all heard they made a lot of hay out of it, of the Khoust University, which actually is finished and started working, which is quite an amazing project. The city, the King Abdullah Economic City, is going to go ahead. Probably the one in Jizan is going to go ahead because of social reasons. They need to create jobs in the south near the Yemeni border, and I think it's a priority of the government. The other cities, I'm not sure there'll be such a rush in going into it because they seem to be mostly real estate schemes to favor the royal families than anything else. But there are many other projects that are coming along. The Dow Chemical Project, the largest project the largest chemical project in the world ever, is starting. They're talking about establishing it. There are a lot of negotiations taking place right now. It'll be over $20 billion in investment. The $10 billion investment with Sumitomo is already working, producing, and they are going to double that project within the next 5 years. Another project we don't speak much about, which is huge and of great importance, is the Ras Azur project in Saudi Arabia to create a diammonium phosphate plant and a big aluminum project. This is linked to a major railroad that's being built between the north of the country to the Persian Gulf, which will bring all the goods, all the mining products, the phosphates in this case, and the bauxite to the Gulf, to be used by MAN, which is a state-owned venture, really, with the private sector, mostly the stock market in Riyadh. As I said, the lending is beginning to get a little better, and the stock market, really, as you mentioned earlier, declined all the way from 14,000 in 2008 to 4,130. That's a big loss. It's much bigger than any of our markets here. It's coming back. We're back at 6,300 today. But this is important because it's truly, in spite of everything you hear, it's truly the only real stock market in the Gulf, because it has a capitalization of over $350 billion compared to, say, Dubai, which has about $40 or $43 billion in capitalization. So that's really the only true market in the region. In the UAE, of course, you have two different vision here. You have the Abu Dhabi and Dubai. Let me talk about Abu Dhabi a little bit. Abu Dhabi is extremely well off right now because their actual requirement for break-even, including social expenses and so on, is probably between $20 and $30 a barrel. That's, you know, you'll read many, many figures on that. But that allows Abu Dhabi to build $45 billion of reserves, fresh reserves, every year. Now, Abu Dhabi lost a lot of money, of course, on its sovereign wealth funds last year, and probably maybe as far up as $150 billion. But that still leaves them with about $400 billion, which is nothing to sneeze at this point. Abu Dhabi has been pouring an enormous amount of money in the economy, in the banks, starting in December. And they are pushing very hard on the new projects. The new industrial development projects, the largest aluminum project in the world, 1.5 million tons per year, is going ahead, to my surprise. But it was sort of on the back burner for a long time, but now they're back on the front burner. And the Borouge, which is the largest chemical plant in Abu Dhabi, is about to double. Is thinking of doubling production, and mainly the nuclear plants are really on the very, very front burner. And we're talking for the first four plants, where the contract is going to probably be signed in November. We're talking $47 billion for the first four plants. So we don't know who's going to get those plants, by the way. But it has to be, if Congress says nothing before October 30th on the agreement signed in January, this will go ahead. And it could very well go to American companies. Anyway, there are three big bids on this, and the American companies are big in all three bids in any event, so nobody's going to suffer. One thing that, of course, is dear to everybody's heart in Abu Dhabi and dear to many people's heart is the cultural projects. Now, that may sound cultural, but we're talking about $10, $20 billion of investments here. The museums are going ahead. They have broken ground on the Louvre. They have broken ground on the American museum? Oh, the Guggenheim. Thank you. And so on. And they're building the island, all the development around the same island that goes with it. It's big, big money. Now, Dubai, of course, has a few more problems. As we all know, Dubai is having, has a big debt. The government of Dubai has stated $80 billion. The reality from the, and I get that figure directly from the president of the Chamber of Commerce, is really $120 billion in debt. That's a lot of money. And that money is going to come due within 3 to 5 years, and some of it is due right now. So everybody says, don't worry, Abu Dhabi will bail out Dubai. Well, I'm not sure I agree with that. The Abu Dhabi will give some money to Dubai. They've already taken $10 billion in the first issue of bonds in May, and they probably will take the next $10 billion, which is due in November. However, the problem for Abu Dhabi is that if they want to bail out a lot of these white elephants in Dubai, they have to sell their own assets because most of their money is invested, a lot of them in very sovereign wealth funds. If Abu Dhabi sells assets now, they're going to lose money. Why would they do that? So I think they'll bail Dubai out slowly, a drop at a time, and Dubai will just have to survive in the meantime. Dubai will also suffer from the fact that we in the U.S. are putting a lot of pressure on Dubai to stop dealing with Iran quite as much. And so some of that business is being transferred to Hong Kong right now, I'm told. The impact of the decline, as you mentioned very well, is really hurting the poor laborers and being transferred out, and also the young professionals. I have many students in Dubai who are looking for jobs presently because they've lost their jobs. But things are not as dire as all that. Dubai will continue to survive because it has this absolutely amazing product in Jebel Ali, which is going to continue. This transshipment center and manufacturing center is one of the marvels of the world. It will decline in importance, and the amounts going through it will decline, but it's going to continue. It's the best in the world, really. One thing that a positive, in a way, is that with the problems we have with Iran and the problems in Pakistan, we may see, at first I was thinking, well, there'll be a lot less money going into the Dubai banks because Iran's, as I will say later, is earning less money. However, it could work just the other way around because there are so many people worried in Iran about the future of Iran and so many people in Pakistan worried about the situation in Pakistan that we actually could see more money being transferred into the banks in Dubai. We're talking over $15 billion a year here. Of course, and one very positive thing in many ways is that these big white elephants have been killed. The kilometer-high tower, which was announced in May, in March when I was in Dubai, is probably not going to see the daylight. I'm glad. I would hate to have an office 1 kilometer high up in the air. But And the whole vision of having Dubai being an entertainment park and bringing Chinese tourists, mass Chinese tourism, to spend 3 or 4 days in the various parks in Dubai is just when the temperature is 43 in the shade, was very, in my view, not a clever way of doing business. But there's still destination tourism, but a totally much lower key one. Now, Bahrain, let me speak just a little bit on Bahrain, because the funny thing is Bahrain really has suffered a little bit from the impact of oil prices. As I said here, $3 billion is coming less in their coffers. However, Bahrain is hampered by the lack of capital, the lack of gas. Believe it or not, the actual figures of Bahrain is that they only have 3 years of natural gas left, and everything in Bahrain runs on natural gas. Now, people will say, well, that's not really true, but depending on how you look at the figures, that could be true. I'm not overly worried about it, because they have spent a lot of time and efforts to look for new sources of gas. They've hired, they made a big bid where ExxonMobil bid, Occidental bid. Occidental won the bid and will probably, we think anyway, find more gas for Bahrain. So Bahrain will be okay for maybe 10 or 15 years to come. It still nevertheless has had a major impact, because they've had to delay their expansion of the aluminum plant, which creates an enormous amount of employment. The problem with Bahrain, though, the economy in Bahrain, when you go there, feels good. People have work. There's less unemployment, even among the Shia now, than there's ever been. Bahrain feels good when you go there in terms of economy. But in terms of society, there are major tensions. And the parliament is basically dysfunctional today. And this is really coming from the fact that you have a political problem. So I think the problems of Bahrain is not easily solvable and will not be solved just by an increase in money from overseas or from Saudi Arabia or wherever. They have to face their own internal problems. And the problem is the division within the royal family, between the crown prince and the prime minister, and in society, especially among the Shia, between the two main groups, Al-Haq and Al-Wafaq, where Al-Wafaq is in parliament and sort of tries to work with the government, and Al-Haq is really in the streets every night, burning tires and attacking the troops. So basically the extremists, both on the prime minister's side and on Al-Haq, are really controlling the debate now. And the center, there's a very large center in Bahrain of Shia, moderate Shia, well-educated Shia, and moderate Sunni, well-educated royal family members and Sunnis who really would like to work together. But the system is built in such a way now that the extremists are controlling the system and nothing's happening. So if we could help resolve, I mean, if the Bahrainis themselves could resolve these issues, I think Bahrain would be in a very good position to rebound. Now, one thing, a note of warning on Qatar here. You know, everybody thinks Qatar can do no wrong. They are going to double. They are in the process of doubling production of liquid natural gas to 70 million tons per year with the help of ExxonMobil and Maersk and a lot of other companies like this and Occidental. But in my view, things are not as wonderful as they are, because a year ago, the price of gas to the Far East was as far up as $20 a million BTU for LNG. That was great. They were making money, you know, hand over fist. The cost is only $3 a million BTU. But now with the new definition of prices, and the prices to the Far East, which is most of the production sold to the Far East, is based on a percentage of oil prices. Well, the oil prices went down, you know, from 147 when it was $20 a million BTUs in Korea. It went down now to basically for the local oil to about $65. And that means the Qataris are still making a little bit of money, but not very much money. And mostly they have a debt load that is in the, well, over $100 billion for building these enormous plants they've done. And they finance them. So Qatar is making money more today, more money on its very small production of oil than it is on its gas. So I think things are not as rosy as all that in Qatar. They're still okay. They're not going to go down the drain anytime soon. But it's not the beautiful picture we like to think. Now, let me go a couple notes on Iran. I've already talked about that. Originally, the budget was computed, and I get that figure from your colleagues at the IMF, so it's got to be true. Yes, it's got to be true. that the budget was computed $90 per barrel. Well, it so happens that the price is not even $70, well, it's $75 lately, but, you know, the Gulf's price, of course, is less, much less than NYMEX. When NYMEX, the price on NYMEX is $75, the Gulf only gets $68 because of the distance and the mix of crude and so on. So they, basically, the Iranians are going bust. And that's really the point I'd like to make here, because that has major implications from a political standpoint, I think. The subsidies, Iran, which is as the supposedly the second largest reserves in the world of oil, in fact, probably third, are importing gasoline. They're importing 130,000 barrels a day of gasoline. They have the second largest gas reserves in the world, right after Russia, and they are net importers of gas from Turkmenistan. It's unbelievable. Why? Because they don't have the money, really, to invest in their own fields. And, you know, there is no one is going to invest in their own fields today. Even though the Chinese promised to invest in the fields, they've signed probably 10, 12 agreements with Iran, but they haven't spent a penny yet. Chinese are very good about saying we will do it, but not doing it. And but they're keeping their foot in the door so that when it does open, they'll be there. In any event, what's left for Iran is that Iran can only fund its deficits through printing money, which I'm sure the IMF will agree with me could be very dangerous from an inflationary standpoint. So they now have an inflation of 25% per year. That could become not Zimbabwean, but, you know, very high inflation. That doesn't mean the regime will change. Again, Zimbabwe is a good example of that. So I would say the regime in Iran is under a great deal of pressure. It probably will not necessarily fall because of this, but Iran is suffering and will suffer a lot more than it is now. And I have a positive, in spite of all the nasty things I've said about the U.S. presence in Iraq and whatnot, I have some pretty good view of today of what's happening in Iraq. I think what's happening in the bids on the oil fields, which is not given to the large oil companies, where BP just signed 3 or 4 days ago, was approved by the parliament of Iran for the development of the Rumaila field. Exxon and Lukoil are in battle for the West Qurna field on the basis of $2 profit per barrel, 1.9. This, if it does actually bring the international oil companies in, we will see Iraq becoming a major oil producer and increasing its production to maybe, you know, anywhere from four to 8 million barrels a day in the next 3 to 5 years. It's going to come fairly quickly. So there are some issues there. Of course, they have to resolve the small problems of the Kurdish disputes, and those are very intractable. But they still could produce oil and improve their income substantially. So let me just finish with the conclusion, which I have, if I can find it here. I would say that the situation in the Gulf is very interesting in the sense that because of the economies of the world and so on, their place in the world has increased very dramatically. For instance, the fact is Saudi Arabia will be the largest producer of chemicals in the world within a few years, within 5 to 7 years. And that is represented by the fact that Saudi is the only Arab country in the G20. And it's obviously become the leader of the region, and it's seen as the leader of the region by the other economies. It does create some issues, however, because you may have not followed this. It didn't really make big headlines, but there's a very major trade dispute today between China and Saudi Arabia on the price of methanol and the price of butadienol, if that's the way it's pronounced. I'm not sure. But anyway, it's creating a big tension, and it's very important for the Saudis because they've spent hundreds of billions of dollars establishing new industries that are value-added so that in the long term they can get out of oil, let the Iraqis and the Iranians sell the primary commodity. They will become value-added, knowledge-based industries. They join WTO at a great cost to them in order to do that, and the Chinese are tacking on up to 800% tariffs on their productions because they have a cost of energy which is the lowest in the world. And that's going to end up in WTO court, which means in 5 to 10 years we may get a resolution in favor of the Saudis. In the meantime, the Chinese will have built their own industry better. So I think I think the fact that the Gulf is becoming so important in the world economy means there will be a lot of trade tensions, especially with the Far East. The Saudis will be under great pressure to manage the price of oil a lot more than they have. And the king has said before he likes the price at 75, but I was talking to one of his representatives this weekend, and they tell me he likes the 85 too. But I think 85 is about as high as the Saudis will let it go. When the price went up past 75 on NYMEX last week, Saudi Aramco let it be known that they had 4 million barrels of capacity which they could use at any time, and the price went back down below 75. Nevertheless, the Saudis will keep it between $65 and $85 a barrel, and I think that's what we're going to see in the future. So basically the other two conclusions I've really mentioned before was that I think we will be happily surprised that Iraq will become one of the large, finally, after all these, for the past 30 years, we've heard that Iraq can be one of the largest oil producers, and there always something happens that stops them from doing it. But if they actually work with the IOCs, as they seem to be, then we could see that happening within 3 to 5 years, and we could see them producing 6 million barrels a day without too much trouble. And Iran, on the other hand, will continue to suffer tremendously from its present situation. And maybe I'll leave it at that.
Thank you very much. Well, you've heard the macroeconomic view, you've heard the social political view, and you've heard the view from a sectoral analytical standpoint, business even standpoint. You've heard three different dimensions. Now it's over to you. You have questions, comments. There are a number of recognized experts in the audience, so I look forward to any comments they might have. I might even turn to Ritva Reinecke if she has time and wants to react. She's director of policy for the Middle East at the World Bank. But let me open it up and see if there are any questions. Yes.
Thank you. Leslie Rorton from Reuters. I was wondering if you could, Masoud, if you maybe could explain to us what you see, since Saudi Arabia is the only one in the G20 and the IMF has been talking, and not only in Pittsburgh but also in Turkey recently, about correcting the imbalances. What do you see as the role of the Middle East, especially in the Saudis, in this rebalancing issue? So what kind of role, considering you're saying that their reserves are going to go up quite extensively? And I was wondering also, could you give us an update on how close you are to an agreement with Iraq on a program?
Shall we just go directly and answer that question, and then we'll open it up again?
Well, I think what the G20 is really looking to Saudi Arabia for is to stabilize, to be one of the stabilizing factors in the world, and especially in the oil markets. And that's why, there's been some talks, I think, on pushing the Saudis either to increase production and to get the prices down a bit. But I think the Saudis want to maintain that band. And I was going to say 65 to 75, but from what I hear this weekend, it's more like 65 to 85. But I think that's what the G20 will be looking for and are really looking to the Saudis for that. And they see that the Saudis are becoming a very important industrial power, and that also will play a great role in the control of the pricing of the chemical in the world, and that will impact in the long term. Iraq. You wanted to know about Iraq. Well, the BP has actually signed a contract with the Iraqi government, to my great surprise. But anyway, they have in joint venture with the Chinese, and that has been approved by parliament in Iraq. So it has happened. And once the parliament is always the problem, once that's done, it's going to happen. The next one is the negotiation taking place as we speak between the oil company, between the minister, Sharistani, and ExxonMobil and Lukoil on the other side, where they're fighting whether or not it's at $1.9 profit or not. And we'll see how that goes. But I think it'll follow the same pattern as BP. So even though 3 weeks ago I was very, very negative about this ever happening, all of a sudden I'm much more positive.
Masood?
Yeah. I think I just say maybe a couple of small points. One is that on the issue of how we see the sort of evolution of reserves in particular as part of the global rebalancing, well, one dimension of it is, you know, what you've just heard. But I think you have to think about this as a cyclical thing, and particularly if you're an oil producer, commodity producer. And this year, what we have seen is the counter-cyclical dimension of it. So the fact that the GCC countries have continued to be able to spend has also contributed to sustaining their contribution to sort of world demand, if you like, during a time when demand was going down. So it's kind of important to remember that as well. So I don't think that we see a problem with the pattern where during upturns there's a buildup in reserves, and then there is a, because it's a cyclical commodity, you have periods when there's those reserves being used up. On Iraq, I think you had a more operational question, which was how close we are to an IMF agreement with Iraq. Well, I think on Iraq, the only thing I would say to you, Leslie, is that, as I said, we've been having a conversation with them about having a program that could support them financially. The issue is not, as was just pointed out, with Iraq down the road, you can see a buildup in oil production and also oil prices going up will help them. But this year and next year, they do have a financing gap, which comes from the fact that prices have gone down and their break-even price for their budget is higher than it is for other countries. We've had good discussions with them, including in Istanbul, but we haven't yet got to the point where we are able to conclude that discussion. So that's where we are.
Thank you very much. I think Ritva Reinecke has a comment or a question. Can you raise your hands? Oh, yes, there you are. Okay.
Thanks very much. It's really worried because you excited me. So I just working at the World Bank and also on the in the MENA region. I just wanted to say for the panel that I did find it very fascinating, particularly the perspective from the Gulf and all these like government-led industrialization and all that. It's fascinating. It's fascinating for someone like myself who has been in development for a very long time. And when I go to Dubai and we talk about government and all that, and I can't find that government. So it's just entirely fascinating to hear on the one hand the business side and on the other hand then these absolutely unique globalization experience that is in the Gulf. So I want to thank you all for the presentations. Maybe just two things really about linking, but adding. I guess we always work with our sister organization, the Fund, in such a way that where the last slide of Masood's is really where our agenda is. And I want to pick up employment as one of the big issues because it always comes up, and it comes up when we interact with the Arab representatives, especially in the World Bank in our case, employment and jobs. So we are going to come out with a new report coming out from the print shop in the coming week or so, which is about jobs in a way, but it's about private sector development. And it is called From Privilege to Competition. And it's not a haphazard name. It really is what the name says. And it basically looks at jobs is the desire. It needs a dynamic private sector. Has there been reforms? Yes, there have been reforms. Has the private sector become dynamic? Not really. We look at diversification, productivity, use a lot of micro survey work that we have been doing over the years. And in a way, then look at number of areas that are important for the private sector, finance, access to land, regulation, and things like that. What we see from the micro evidence is really not to say that, oh, you have to do this reform or you have to do that and then it all will happen. We see a very serious arbitrariness in the way firms are treated. And there are the ones that are privileged and they do really well. And then there are the ones that are not privileged and they have a tough time of competing. And in a way, we bring it then to the political economy issues, is use examples like China to say that China opened space for the private sector and really argue that unless there is a very strong opening up for the private sector to operate, the jobs will not come. It's a demand side issue. There are supply side issues, but it's really a demand side issue. So maybe at one point we can engage on that one, and we intend to engage a lot in the region in that area. But really, it brings together the politics, the private sector, and the closeness that the political elite and system has with enterprises and the impact that it has on the rest of the private sector. So the other piece of work that we are doing, but it's not yet done, but it's underway, is a major flagship report on finance. And also, in a way, we have, of course, share very much the fund's view on saying that, yes, in a major crisis, it may be very good to not to have a strong financial sector, but when you want to grow and have progress, it's an important element. And some progress definitely has been achieved in Egypt, but there's a long way to go. I guess finally, on the social front, we work a lot on subsidy reforms, and it's really interesting for me. I've worked in the MENA region less than 2 years, and just coming from many other regions, developing regions in the world, and this prevalence of subsidies and lack of social safety nets is really quite amazing. And before coming to MENA, I used to be in South Africa as the bank's country director, and I always, then coming to MENA, thought, gosh, in South Africa, everybody called each other comrade, but they relied still the market system fully, and there was no subsidies. And we have worked, we have done an enormous amount of analysis on subsidies, subsidy reform, the impact. In Iran, for instance, subsidies were 18% of GDP during the high prices of food and oil. And we have done so many analyses, and in many cases, absolutely very difficult to do any reform whatsoever. And it is a fascinating political economy, I think, of in the subsidy case. And we are now working on the political economy. I don't know whether it will make any difference, but those subsidies are some unique feature in the economy. And somehow people feel that they have some control over something having those subsidies, but they are very, very inefficient, and reforming them is very difficult. So maybe just really thank you very much from my side, and just sharing with you some of the preoccupations that we have. Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, Ritva. I will come back to the panel, particularly on the question of jobs, which seems such a central issue, as Ritva said, linking the economics and the politics. And when you were talking about subsidies, I was reminded of my time working on the agricultural subsidies in the industrial countries. And I want to pronounce a general law of subsidies. Once you give a subsidy, it's very difficult to take it away. Yes, the gentleman there with the hand raised.
Yeah, Paul Tennessee from the University District of Columbia. I have two quick questions. regarding jobs, for many years now, international labor, the ILO, we've been saying that we have growth, jobless growth. In other words, growth but no jobs. And we've been having development without jobs. So I'd like that to be addressed. And I'd like an evaluative opinion of the relations that Chavez has been developing with Libya in recent times. Libya was over there. They signed a number of agreements, if you have an opinion on that. And one last quick one. What's the impact of the devaluing U.S. dollar on your analysis?
Three simple questions. I'll come back to the panel. Any other questions? Yes, the gentleman at the back there.
Thank you. Matthew Stevenson, State Department. I work on the Middle East on economic programs there. And two related questions, please. And first of all, sorry, I think this panel was terrific. I've been coming to these things for a little while. This was amongst the best ever, so thank you very much. We talked about how on the downside, as things swung down economically, the Middle East was not as affected because of lack of economic integration. And now on the upside, improvements will not happen as rapidly. Would you say that the Middle East is therefore seeking greater economic integration with the world, especially from the perspective of the United States? Or would you say that the lesson learned from this experience is one where they would not want to expose themselves to too much further econ integration on the basis of having weathered this storm the way they did? And related to that, you talked a lot about the differences between oil producers and non-oil producers in the region. I was wondering, as their fates are integrated and the non-oil producers have been doing relatively well on the basis of spillover effects and whatnot, do you see greater tension between the two, or do you see that they view their economic and political futures as more and more integrated? Thank you.
Very good. Any other questions before I turn it back to the panel? No? Okay. Back to the panel. I don't know, Marina, you may want to start this time.
Okay. Let me talk a bit about this issue, two issues I think I want to address. One is that of the whether these countries are seeking economic greater integration in the global system, or less integration in the global system. There is no doubt that they see their future in greater integration. There is no country in the region I know of, I mean, even Libya at this point, that is really seeking for better integration. All the efforts that the oil-producing countries are making to diversify their economy only make sense in the framework of greater economic integration in the global economy. Saudi Arabia does not have a market for the largest capacity in producing, you know, this enormous capacity for in the chemical industry that it is developing, and this is true of all of them. So I think that there is absolutely no doubt that that's a direction in which they want to go. The problem is that for some of the countries, economic integration in the global economy is extremely difficult. The real problem that we are facing is that of countries that really have no place at this point in the global economy. I think if you look at in the Arab world, the best case, or not the best case, but the most dramatic case, is that of Yemen, which is very quickly losing its place as an oil exporter. It was never a huge oil exporter, but whatever it has, it's running out. And it really does not have anything else to tie to the world economy. So that in the end, these are countries that, unless they can totally change a direction economically, they'll end up by becoming wards of the oil producing countries, because they don't have anything else. The issue of the tension between oil producer and non-oil producers, that is a very difficult question, I think, because on one level, what you have is still the rhetoric of Arab unity, of Arab integration, about how the oil producer have to lift up, the rest of the Arab world. This is a common resource, and so on. At the practical level, that does not work out. The oil producing countries are investing in the rest of the Arab world, when they see a business opportunity there, when they see an opportunity to produce more, so that you see, you know, there is a lot of Arab money going to real estate in Lebanon, there is Arab money going to tourism in Morocco, but this is simply based on what they see as business opportunities and not as solidarity. Does that mean that political tensions are going to increase? I don't think they are going to increase on the level of oil-producing countries on one side and other countries on another. There are tensions on the level of certain countries. For example, one that you see that it's always there just under the surface is the tension that exists between Saudi Arabia and Egypt. That although on a lot of issues they are on the same side, but there is also a sense on the part of Egypt that they really should be the leaders of the Arab world, not recognizing a leadership role for Saudi Arabia. And at the same time, the Saudis not really being terribly inclined to accept a role for Egypt, which, you know, from an economic point of view does not counter the way they do. So that you see other tensions coming up, for example, because between Qatar and some of the other countries. But those are not necessarily oil producer versus non-oil producer. It's more Qatar that does, in sort of, has started trying to leverage his economic position into a diplomatic position, into a, you know, trying to become a peacemaker in the region, and that is certainly creating a lot of negative reaction on the part of the other countries, although not necessarily on this oil producer, non-oil producer divide.
Yes, Masoud, particularly, I don't know if any of you actually want to comment on the jobs question. Very much welcome that, but you know, in any event, whatever you can.
Well, I can come back to the issue of jobs later, or you can do it now.
Okay, fine. Let's go ahead.
Okay.
Well, let me, I think, come back to the issue of, it's a bit linked to jobs, but I think it's really linked a bit more also to looking forward on growth, because if you make the distinction between economies which rely primarily on migrant labor for the labor force, put them aside for a minute, because the safety valve for them is to control the number of workers that they bring in. But if you look at the large economies which have young, growing populations, the numbers, and if you look at the numbers in the back of this report, and look at some of the growth numbers for the period last 10 years, they've improved over the last 2 or 3 years, but the history of growth rates in these large oil-importing emerging markets in the Middle East is not that they are among the fastest-growing economies, and that's the reason why they've been struggling to catch up in terms of providing the jobs for the populations that are growing and quite young. And I think the challenge going forward, and this is a discussion we'll have next year, I'm sure when we have this conversation a year from now, competitiveness and trying to generate faster growth and more jobs in these economies is going to become a central preoccupation. Because over the last three or four years, the high price of oil has really had a spillover effect on the region as a whole. Sending migrant workers abroad is another safety valve. You don't have to go very fast yourself if you can basically send a lot of people to go and work in the Gulf. But even if they don't come back, which, you know, some have, but the vast majority are still working there, they're not going to be growing in the same pace. So if you look at the growth of the labor force, then migration is not going to provide the same kind of safety valve that it has over the past 4 years. So I do think that that's going to be an issue that we're going to be talking about more. And it's linked to another point I just want to address, which is diversification. We've all been talking about diversification. If you look at the oil exporting countries, they're following quite different models of diversification. Some of them are diversifying into industries that are linked to hydrocarbons. And that's kind of one way to diversify. You go into producing downstream industries, you go into ancillary chemical industries. And others, and Dubai is a sort of good example of that, have diversified by building what is a sort of service, tourism, real estate hub for the region. And that's a different kind of model of diversification. And yet others, you know, Bahrain, Qatar, Dubai, are trying to get into a different model, which is financial sector as a diversification of financial services. And I think it'll be interesting to see how, in light of how the world is changing, and in particular how the structure of the global financial business is changing, how that will affect these different models of diversification. So over the coming year, I do see for us, particularly in the fund, a piece of work that we would want to do a bit more on looking at this comparative experiences in diversification and seeing if you can draw some lessons from that. Thanks.
This issue of job is really fascinating because there is an enormous discussion going on in Saudi Arabia today, actually, between the government and the private sector on these matters. 95% of the employees in the private sector are foreigners, and in the public sector, it's almost the opposite. And when I say public sector, I mean Saudi Aramco, SABIC, the big industrial companies that are more or less state-controlled. The civil service is trying to impose on the merchants in particular limits on how many foreigners they can import, they can bring in. But, of course, the private sector wants to keep its sort of maybe slave system is a bit of an exaggeration, but it's not so far from that. And the people who will criticize the Saudi laborers the most are the private sector in Saudi Arabia, who says the Saudis, they're lazy, they cannot work, they don't want to learn, et cetera, et cetera. The fact is, yes, they will, and I know that from personal experience, but you need to pay them. That's the problem. And the private sector doesn't want to pay them. Now, there are a number of issues to that effect. It's coming in particular, in one of the biggest dialogues that's taking place right now in the kingdom, is the, and I'm sorry to get a little technical here, but it's on the pricing of feedstock. Companies like SABIC can buy raw materials for very, very little, almost nothing, and can reach because they're energy-based and energy costs very little. They can then export to China and make a lot of money. The private sector is not able to buy energy from the government, meaning propane, butane, that kind of things, at any price below world market, so that they're not willing to make any effort into providing jobs for Saudis if it costs them more money, because they have no more advantage in being Saudis if you're in the private sector than you are anywhere else. So the discussion is whether or not the government should sell its butane and so on to the private sector at a cost basis plus profit, which is what the Saudis negotiated under WTO. If they did that, there'd be a major revolution in the kingdom, because then the state could demand from the private sector that the private sector actually train their Saudis just like Saudi Aramco is doing. That's why they can run Saudi Aramco with 85-89% Saudis. So that issue is not resolved, and it's not resolved because the Saudis have a lot of lobbies just like we do, and the lobbies from the private sector prefer to not have local workers working for them. They want to be able to continue on the import of foreign laborers. The civil servants are saying, if you want that, we're not going to give you cheap energy. That's just that simple. And that's a decision that will have to be made by the king. It should have been made by the king 3 or 4 years ago, but they're sort of, it's in a very Saudi way. It is taking a long, long, long time. So I'm not terribly negative on the total outlook, but I'm negative in the sense that it's going to take time. And once they do that, once they decide to really sell to their private sector the same prices that they sell to their own energy company, the state that is, then you will find a lot of job creation within the kingdom. But it's not a given, and it's not sure the civil service will win that battle. So that's really all I could say there.
Thank you. Marina, did you want to say anything on jobs?
On this issue of job creation, I think what we are seeing to a very large extent is really the problems that, I mean, there are certainly technical issues. I'm not trying to get away from that. But there are also very deep political problems. And we can, and it really comes from the dysfunctionality of the political systems of some of these countries. If you go back sort of in time to, you know, the mid-1970s when oil prices first went up, right? Arab countries really did not have any, had very little, the oil-producing countries, sorry, the Gulf countries, had very little capacity for managing these new resources. They have acquired the technical know-how. We no longer have petrodollars sort of floating around and deposited in Western banks because nobody knows how to spend the money. That has changed drastically. These countries have acquired the technical competence to develop a project, to spend the money, and so on. What you still have is a very dysfunctional political systems, essentially, where you have these economies that are becoming more and more modern economies and economies integrated in the global systems that are still being run by, you know, as if this were the way these countries have been run in the past. So that one of the problems that you really run into in the development of a real private sector, in the allocation of land to the various industries, what you call the arbitrariness of the system, which is very clear in some countries. If you look at Kuwait, I mean, it's glaring the way in which the availability of land for different businesses, you know, how the land is apportioned and so on. It's really related to the nature of the political system. And therefore, those are problems that are going to be very, very difficult to solve because it's not a question of technical advice. It's really a question of where the power relations are in those countries.
Thank you very much. Just a comment on the jobs. And then there was a question on the impact of the dollar devaluation on the region, which I don't know if any of you want to pick up. The job question is absolutely critical, and especially given the extraordinarily rapid growth of the labor force in the region, is directly linked to the difficulties of developing the private sector. But also made much more complicated by very large government-induced distortions in the labor market. I mean, I'm originally from Libya, and I visited Libya for the World Bank a couple of times in the last 3 or 4 years. I mean, basically, the government employs the vast majority of Libyans and sets the wage, et cetera, combined with the fact that the private sector has difficulty emerging for all the reasons that have been mentioned. This makes it very difficult to get any kind of endogenous or autonomous job growth. And as Masoud underscored, it's a lot easier to deal with that situation when the global economy is expanding, not just because exports are growing and because oil is up, but because the fact that you have more foreign currency, et cetera, allows you to also grow your service sector domestically. And this is also potentially a very big source of growth in these Gulf countries where the issue is not export. They have all the exports that they need in the foreseeable future. The issue is rather the development of the domestic service sector where a lot of the jobs potentially originate, assuming that people want to take them. And there have also been reports about, of course, the weakness of education in the region. This is also a major issue, the quality of education and the conformance, if you like, of the education that people are getting and the demands of the global economy are another very important impediment. There was a question then about dollar devaluation and the impact on the region. I don't know if anybody wants to comment on that.
Well, I'm always long on opinions, sometimes a little short on facts, but I think
so
the...
As long as you're not long on the dollar.
Well, in fact, I think the dollar is weak right now, but remember, it's stronger today than it was a year ago. And it's actually gone up almost 20%, 15% or so in the past year, and now it's going down again. Those are cyclical things. I think in the long term, there will be perhaps a weakness of the dollar. But in the short term, I don't think it'll make any difference in the Gulf. The Gulf's still getting all its income in dollars, and it's getting most of its expenses in dollars, because even if the trade with China is going up very rapidly, let's remember the Chinese currency is more or less linked to the dollar. So as far as they're concerned, it doesn't make that much difference. If we could push the Chinese to revalue their yuan or renminbi or whatever we call it, you'd find that there'd be a big switch back to U.S. trade. Right now, the U.S. trade is declining. But the region as a whole will need the dollar and continue to support the dollar. But, of course, they are worried about the budget deficit we have here, and they should be, and the trade deficit. And in the long term, I think we will see some changes, but in the very long term. I think in the short term, nothing will happen. They'll continue to support the dollar.
Yeah. This issue is becoming, I agree on the bottom line, it's going to be a very long term. What we see in the short term, though, is that there are beginning to be divisions among the GCC countries on this issue, and this is slowing down any efforts to integrate the currencies of the GCC countries. They were supposed to move towards a common currency, and what divides them is really this issue of what this common currency should be pegged to. There is one country in the Gulf now which is Kuwait, that has its currency pegged to a basket of different, not to the dollar, but to a basket of different foreign currency. Other countries are talking about that, but there is resistance in many quarters, and as a result, they are making no progress towards, they keep on postponing the decision on whether or not to move towards a common currency, which in turn has repercussion for inter-GCC relations.
I just want to thank you for having organized this.
Well, all right. The IMF no longer comments on currencies. That's very bad news. I'd like to, first of all, thank you all for coming. I think it's been a very nice discussion, very good, very instructive. And I'd like to, on all your behalf, to thank the panel for doing such a great job. Thank you very much.